Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you non-monetized, endorsement-free insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 138, I'm joined by Dr. Yasha Modi and Dr. Will Park for a journal club discussion of three recent articles in major ophthalmology journals. We will discuss drill as a biomarker in retinal vein occlusion, characteristics of patient with sickle cell retinopathy, and the utility of scleral depression in the setting of posterior vitreous detachment. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by a new cohort of retina specialists right after recording our previous retinal physician podcast. This is posting a week later, but was recorded back-to-back at the American Academy of Ophthalmology annual meeting in Chicago. Recording this now on Sunday. Joining me first in alphabetical order, Dr. Yasha Modi from New York University.
All right, glad to still be here.
Everyone else left you. And joining us from the corner of the room, Dr. Will Park from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Thanks for having me as well, and I'm excited to finally share in the experience of doing this in person.
We're going to talk about some journal club articles from the last month, one from JAMA Ophthalmology, two from American Journal of Ophthalmology, and then we'll talk a little bit about Subday, because I actually wasn't at subspecialty day this year. I'd be curious what you guys had 5 minutes to kind of talk about your impressions, thoughts on late breakers, other talks that you thought were good, and we'll get that at the end. Let's start with this JAMA Ophthalmology article, which is Association of Disorganization of Retinal Inner Layers with Visual Acuity Response to Antivascular Endothelial Growth Factor Therapy for Macular Edema Secondary to Retinal Vein Occlusion. Take a deep breath after that one. That's Dr. Amy Vebuch and colleagues, including Rishi Singh from Cleveland. Yasha, drill is your little baby. You trained at Cole Eye Institute. First of all, what is drill, and then what do they seek to do in this study?
So, you know, I think drill is a really fascinating concept that was initially started in looking at patients with diabetic macular edema. But the basic concept is we have a sort of organized lamination of the retina, and that can get disrupted. And the more disorganized that is, the thought is that there's more ischemia of the inner retina that could potentially portend a poor prognosis. So in the case of drill, you can essentially look at the inner retinal layers all the way down to the outer plexiform layer. When you look at OCT, the ganglion cell IPL layer is essentially very difficult to distinguish, which is why the Zeiss algorithm kind of lumps them together. But you can compare that to the IPL to the INL interface, and then the INL interface to the OPL interface. And if those layers of the laminations are not clearly distinguished, that's what identifies drill. And that can be manually measured. And that's what this thing is. This is a reading, this is like a reading center tool that's an immensely labor-intensive process, but can provide significant visual prognosis potential.
Yeah, and they pulled 447 patients for this study, BRVOs, CRVOs, and also hemispherics included in that one. Drill in this study, as it been in other studies, you know, if you didn't have drill, you have better visual acuity gains at 6 months. That's been shown in previous studies. If you do have drill at 12 months, your visual acuity gains are less. And drill, interestingly enough, was associated with lower ETDRS scores in BRVO patients, but not in CRVO patients. So that's also interesting. And the final thing was, you know, just the idea and the final conclusion is this may be a biomarker, right? So the ETDRS, you know, score was developed, and now we have all these biomarkers, some of which maybe we won't even have to understand. Maybe there'll be algorithms and, you know, artificial intelligence, deep learning that will take care of it for us. But is drill going to be one of those biomarkers that's factored in? Will Park, your impressions, your thoughts?
Yeah, I guess my first question for you guys is, I understand the potential import regarding its use in clinical trials and when we develop more sophisticated software, but right now, I think we all kind of internalize that you get more disruption to the architecture of the inner retina. It's reflective of ischemia and a bad prognosis, and we've known that for a long time. But I guess my question perhaps for Yasha is how do you practically right now use drill in your discussions with patients or in your management algorithm, and how do you interpret the presence of it? Do you just look, kind of scan through your OCT like you normally do and find a couple sections that have disrupted inner architecture and say, yep, they've got some? Or do you actually try to do this 1 millimeter, 3 millimeter foveal thing?
And my follow-up question to that, and I think Will references, I think a lot of us do this without maybe referencing drill. You know, we may look at it, the initial OCT, and may comment either in our notes or to the patient, you know, maybe the vision won't be as good in terms of gains because I do see some disruption here. And we are referencing drill maybe, but we're not using those terms. So I'm curious, do you use it also, following tools, but do you use it in your documentation?
Right, so I guess the question is there an intuitive metric that sort of understands or gives us the opportunity to look at an OCT and understand disruption of the retina and a disorganization of the retina? And maybe that's not even just the inner retinal process, but it's a outer retinal process as well when we're doing this sort of in-clinic evaluation of the patient. And, you know, there are a number of features that, you know, the nice part about it is when we look at visual acuity, the foveal slice across all biomarkers is the one that really has the most import. So we can oftentimes just look at the horizontal line raster. I like to look at a couple of things. I like to look at integrity of the ellipsoid zone. I like to look at integrity of the external limbing membrane. I like to look for hyperreflective foci, which are these like little white dots on the OCT. And we know that the more hyperreflective foci we have, oftentimes the worse the prognosis. And then disruption, generally what Will is saying, disorganization of the retinal layers. And now the hard part about this is drill changes over time. So when you treat these individuals, drill may morph over time. Mm-hmm. And then the other big problem is when you look at the clinical trials on or the retrospective studies that looked at drill for DME, and even in this clinical trial, the inter-observer correlation is really poor, which means that if Will is looking at it, or Jay, you're looking at it, or I'm looking at it, we may not actually have very good correlation between what defines drill. And so this is a great stepping stone to help us, well, say, well, this is one quantitative metric to help us understand a imaging biomarker, and can we devise more quantitative and potentially automated algorithms to help us understand prognosis a little bit better?
Yeah, and you referenced this. I mean, one of the interesting things I wrote at the end of the discussion was that drill in all regions decreases over the first 6 months in the treatment group, but in between 6 and 12 months, it increases. And they said, well, maybe this has to do with we're treating people less aggressively in that time. And I think this is a phenomenon that's been observed more actually with CRVOs also, is that there's this late loss of vision where patients gain vision initially, but then there's some attrition over time. I mean, well, what do you make of that?
I
mean,
I think that's the most important, most interesting part of this article to me was that 6 to 12 month deterioration. And perhaps we're patting ourselves on the back and starting to extend patients out further, and we're keeping edema away. But you may be right. That may be why. That may be a sign that we're going to be dropping their vision if we back off too far with our treatments, if we start seeing the drill reform on these patients or progress.
Well, and then my last question for both of you then is, what do you do? So you have a CRVO that comes in with macular edema. How many injections monthly are you giving them before you extend them? And then how fast do you extend them? What is your extension interval like?
I think it depends on how ischemic they are as well, but in general, I probably go 3 or 4 injections in before I even consider extending, but I'm becoming progressively conservative as I get older, and so I treat monthly longer until I'm convinced that I've achieved stability. And oftentimes, I don't know what you guys do, but I oftentimes do another angiogram before I consider extending out
further. So when you said for ischemia, is that your metric still? When you're essentially getting FAs on all first-time RVO patients?
I'm not sure I'm that absolute, but I certainly do generally do it. I think it gives me a lot of value. I don't have OCT angiography, so the fluorescein angiography is what I use, and the Optos obviously is very useful for that. But I do like redoing that. Part of that's just academic for me to kind of see how the ischemia is changing over time, but it does guide my therapy a little bit.
Yasha, what do you do?
Well, I just wanted to make another comment about OCT. Like Dan was here on the podcast just earlier, and we talked about OCTA and, you know, as a potential tool where we oftentimes don't really know what to do with it. And OCTA can kind of mislead you in these situations, because where you have a lot of edema, we actually times have a sort of a loss of the capillary capillary beds that are visible on OCTA. And so it may mislead you to think, well, oh, there was significant ischemia at the time of presentation, and then now we have sort of diminished the edema, and now all of a sudden the vasculature looks much better on OCT angiography. I think that's a projection artifact that we're seeing in OCT angiography. And so there's definitely a clear role if you really wanted to establish the degree of ischemia for FA in these cases.
I think that's a great point. I mean, I think every imaging modality will have a limitation depending on the situation, right? So like one of the limitations of fluorescein in CRVO is if they have tons of hemorrhage everywhere, then the blockage is going to interfere with your ability to assess the hypoperfusion. Those are two different reasons they can have hypofluorescence, right? The blockage from the heme or the hyperperfusion from their ischemia. And so OCTA, you're right, it is not useful when there's significant edema because it distorts the machine's ability to segment correctly and reconstruct that vascular. You're going to whelm yourself with what the vasculature looks like. I think the interesting point, because you talked about reassessing the perfusion, there's a lot of studies that showed, especially in ischemic CRVOs, that we don't necessarily change the disease process, right? That if they're that ischemic, for example, that they get neovascularization, like they showed in the Houston group and like the RAVE trial, or RELATE, a similar trial that was looking at, you know, treating ischemia to treat edema, that either treatment of the ischemia to treat edema or just treating someone like this with anti-VEGF, if they have NVI up front and then you stop treatment 9 to 12 months later, they still get NVI at most of them. They come back. So it doesn't seem to be as mutable a process as diabetes, for example. So it's interesting that you do that. There's nothing wrong with it. I think academically it's very interesting. I don't personally do it. Maybe I should do it more often. But I wonder, again, if you do you see significant differences?
In the peripheral ischemia?
Yeah.
Not a lot. You're right. Occasionally I'll get a patient who's kind of moderately ischemic who I feel like I've really responded favorably to the VEGF and I feel comfortable extending them out further. But basically it's reinforcing my desire to, if they're really ischemic, either stay on the anti-VEGF more aggressively or add laser. But what it really does is, if I'm going to add laser, it helps me target the laser. So
that's it all wide field imaging? Is it ultra wide field imaging that you're getting?
Yeah.
It's very useful. Well, our next article will be Clinical and Ophthalmic Factors Associated with Severity of Sickle Cell Retinopathy, published in AJO this month. Senior author Adrian Scott, primary author, first author, I'm going to mess this up, Zhang Yun G. Duan. This was from Wilmer Eye Institute. Will, you just want to tell us a little bit about this article about sickle cell and what they found?
Yeah, sure. Probably the fastest way to do this is just to tell people to refer to your previous podcast with Adrian Scott, which would be a little more informative than whatever I'm about to try to do. But this was about 300 patients, and what they basically did was they have a sickle cell clinic in Maryland, and they captured patients who both had an hematology visit there and who also saw retina specialists within 1 year after the visit there. So they were capturing patients who had some degree of retinal disease or at least a reason for a referral, and categorized them into the group that had sickle cell and other kind of what they called sickle cell anemia group, which had some other kind of subtypes to it, and then a separate group which they called the genotypic variants, which is basically sickle SC disease, and looked at what factors caused them to move towards non-proliferative and proliferative sickle retinopathy. And it reiterated a couple things and reminded us a couple things, one of which is that, of course, the second group, the genotypic variants group with the SC disease, developed sickle retinopathy at a higher rate, and proliferative sickle retinopathy, I think at around 55% of those had proliferative sickle retinopathy versus only about 20-25% of the group with sickle cell disease, the standard SS disease. And male, gender, and age were correlated with the development of proliferative sickle retinopathy in the SS group. And there was a trend towards that in the genotypic variant group, although it did not meet statistical significance. They did commentate a small number of the genotypic variants, the SC group, so that's why they didn't have quite as much statistical power there. And that there, it may be protective to have chronic transfusions, and it basically visual symptoms are a good predictive factor for the development of proliferative disease. So if you have a patient with sickle retinopathy with sickle disease who has floaters or distortion in their vision, that can be a very reasonable way to indicate the need for referral to a retinal specialist.
We're not going to talk about treatment yet because this study didn't really look at treatment. It was just looking at characteristics and prognosis. I think the visual symptoms thing is really interesting. I had never really thought of that. I mean, it makes sense. We know that when they have symptoms, that usually reflects that something's going on, because many of these patients are asymptomatic and they have disease. And so if they have symptoms, it's often signs they have vitreous hemorrhage, which would be stage 4 sickle cell retinopathy, which is the time we start thinking about we should probably be treating these patients, and there's different options at that point. Limitations, I'll just kind of go through them. They had a pretty strict inclusion criteria. They referenced this in the second to last paragraph of the paper. They don't have records for all these patients, so they may be underestimating the prevalence of retinopathy in their community. So that's why they think that there's differences between the bigger study. We've seen huge studies from Miami back in the day, which is an old paper, I think, that Clarkson was on. Jamaica, that's one of the classic papers, a huge sickle cell population. And other papers from other countries throughout the other hemispheres. So I think that sickle cell disease, and Yasha, I'm going to have you comment next, because I know this is something you loved as a resident and still kind of like to talk about. This is your first grand rounds as a resident.
Yes,
I still
it was.
Have the slides. Those are great slides. It's such an interesting disease process, because depending on where you are in the world, and this is what I talked with Adrian Scott, you may see a lot of this and you may say zero of this. I've had visitors from the Middle East who have never seen sickle cell retinopathy. And that may have thalassemia-related retinopathy, have other things going on there. But sickle cell is really, really something that depends on where you are if you're going to see it. So if you trained in certain parts of the country, you have no experience treating it. We all trained in urban environments, and Will's now in Minneapolis, where he probably sees less than you see now in New York. So tell us a little about your thoughts on sickle cell disease. First of all, thoughts on what Will discussed, and then we can talk a little about treatment.
Well, I think, first a big shout out to Wilmer, because they have really sort of pushed forward the entire literature over like 50 years on sickle cell disease, starting with Mort Goldberg, who really established the stages that we know in sickle cell, and then Dr. Scott, who's really kind of pushed that envelope even further. But it's crazy in 6 years how little we understand about who's likely to benefit from treatment, who's likely to actually progress to becoming symptomatic. It's a really sort of dynamic disease. And I think it, you know, there are some individuals where I'm almost confident I'm going to end up having to laser them, and I just wait another 6 weeks and they look significantly better. And it's that part that makes it incredibly frustrating. I saw a lot of this in my residency in Miami. I saw very little of it in Cleveland, exactly as you were pointing out. And now I'm seeing a lot of it back in New York again. And it is a very frustrating disease where I love evidence. You know I love evidence. And this is a disease process where we don't have a lot of great evidence to sort of help us understand who we should be worried about in this disease process.
And regarding your point regarding the involution of CFANs, that 30% of the eyes in this study with proliferative sickle retinopathy were not treated. So it's just a reminder to fellows and people out there that observation in many circumstances can be done.
And we're all biased. I'm gonna prepare this. We're all biased because we trained at the similar institution for residency, right? So, and I think one of the things we learned that was carried forward was observation can be really helpful. And the rate of CFAN regression has been reported higher than that if you look back in literature. It's been as high as 2/3 of these CFANs will auto-infarct and they regress, and then you don't have to do anything. What you said is exactly right, Yash. Anytime I tell fellows and trainees this, anytime you see a stage or a disease process where there's multiple treatment options and there's not one definitive, that means we probably don't have a good handle on what's going on from an evidence standpoint, right? Because what are the options for stage 4 sickle? You can do nothing. You can do sectoral laser, you can do 360 laser, and then you can even do surgery, right? You can do vitrectomy if you think the hemorrhage is significant enough. Those are all really, really different, and there's arguments to be made by different people for all of these options. I think my bias, I always observe. I watch, and if I am gonna laser, I'm very targeted with my laser. I don't treat every area of non-perfusion. I usually just treat anterior to active CFANs and leave the rest alone. I think less is more, because as you said, but my implicit gut and what a lot of literature shows is, you know, sickle cell patients, unfortunately, can do really badly in circumstances if you put them through too much treatment. But if we could get a better handle, like you're saying, with studies like these, of like, okay, these are the patients which are higher risk, we need to be more aggressive treating these. Okay, this person's most likely to more likely to auto-infarct, I can leave them alone. That would be really, really nice. I mean, do you guys do a similar thing? You don't see a lot of sickle now, Will, but like...
I see a fair amount, actually, because we have a lot of large African immigrant population, but not as much as Miami, or I'm sure Baltimore.
You're talking about African from Africa?
Like primary, first generation African, but not, it's not like Baltimore, but and so perhaps this study would suggest that you should just have a little bit of a higher index of concern for older patients, obviously SC patients, and perhaps gender plays a role as well. And the question for that is why, whether it's due to the hemoglobin being a little higher and something else. Mm-hmm. But the other comment I would just briefly make, especially for residents and fellows who have not done one or more of these surgeries, is that the surgery is very different from other vitrectomy surgeries you've done, and the peripheral vitreous is different. And those CFANs can get this really fibrotic adherent vitreous that, and with peripheral ischemic retina, which can be problematic surgically. So you have to be ready for that.
So then what are the objectives, Will, when you're in the OR, when you have somebody who has a extramacular tractional detachment? Are these individuals that you can even watch until you're seeing that the detachment is progressing more posteriorly? And then when you know that they're progressing more posteriorly, what is your objective and how do you get out of that eye? What makes you happy when you're leaving that surgery?
I think the surgical fundamentals are the same, which is obviously that you just want to lift hyaline at least from the posterior pole as best you can. Doing laser beforehand is nice to the periphery, peripheral to the CFAN to help, but I'm not super aggressive anymore about relieving the CFAN area of hyaloid. I treat it kind of like lattice almost. You try to shave it down over that area, try to relieve anterior to it, but I don't treat that area too aggressively and try really hard not to create a break. And A lot of these patients show up with lamellar macular holes as their tractional attachment's progressing. I don't know if you've all seen that, but I've seen a lot where they have this progressive lamellar hole in the fovea and in temporal traction, which you can see marching towards it. And so I peel ILM on those patients, and to be honest, I don't know whether that's good or bad.
Saying lamellar hole in the setting of hyoid down in these cases.
That's correct.
Yeah.
I think your biggest point, I think, is be careful before you go in, right? So I think try not to go in these eyes because they're difficult. And there's the hyoid, like you said, is almost always down in these cases. They're different than diabetic cases where the hyoid is down. And one of the reasons I think is really different, obviously very different disease process, is the area where there's the area of neovascularization contracture, the retina is much thinner than in a diabetic because it's peripheral. So you're working on the periphery with an HTACT hyoid and tons of HTACT hyoid behind it working back to the macula and optic nerve. It's a completely different process. And the second caution would be whether in the clinic or in the OR is not to, you talked about that, shaving down the CFA, not being too aggressive. You don't want to be lasering on top of them either. So if you're in the clinic and you see a CFA, you shouldn't be directly lasering them the way you would sometimes with diabetic neo, because you can't see it clinically, but if you're in the OR, you would find that sheet of fibrotic hyoid over there. You're going to cause that to contract. You may cause breaks. You may think these things a bad situation much worse. So if you are going to laser them, always leave a slight distance between your laser and that as your laser expands, because you really don't want to be hot or heavy on the CFA. You really want to treat just the area of non-perfusion to try to regress it.
I know some people do a limited retinectomy, just eat up the whole area when the CFA is really bad. I've never been a fan of that.
I don't do that.
Yeah.
Also remember these individuals, you know, Dr. Scott's study demonstrated more likelihood to actually require an intervention in older patients. When you look at the numbers, they're still 40 years old on average
at the time of the intervention,
versus like somebody who's in their early 30s for those who didn't require treatment. So this is a very young group of individuals who are likely to become symptomatic. And this is not a problem that we really sort of have to contend with in their 60s and 70s. It's something, and that's what makes it so hard. The hyoid is sticky. It's hard to remove. It's easy to make breaks.
They get PVR.
And that's definitely a concern. And for your colleague who ends up doing the limited retinectomies, has this person run into difficulty with secondary PVR at the site of the retinectomy?
Well, I don't know anybody personally. People talk about it in meetings. I can't speak to that personally.
He doesn't associate himself.
That's right.
He's like, I don't want to be friends with anyone.
And just to clarify, I think 40 is super old, and I'll never get to 40. Just so you guys know, I'm staying at 37 forever.
We're going to finish off. This is not a research article. This is an editorial written by some of our dear friends and colleagues from Bascom Palmer, who's entitled The Role of Scleral Depression in Modern Clinical Practice. American Journal of Ophthalmology, 100th anniversary issue. Kimberly Tran is an amazing surgeon, wonderful doctor. She's chief resident right now at Bascom Palmer. Steve Schwartz, Bill Smitty, Harry Flynn wrote this editorial. This was in response partially to a editorial previously written by Dr. George Williams about scleral depression. So I'll just talk about basically what they're talking about scleral depression is there evidence that you have to do scleral depression? Does scleral depression offer a benefit in terms of detecting retinal tears in the setting of a posterior vitreous detachment? And what they're trying to talk about is, while yes, it's nice if you can do it, there's no evidence that necessarily offers a benefit in detecting tears. And it may be slightly dangerous from a medical legal perspective to state that it has to be done, because there are plenty of circumstances and reasons why you would not be able to do a scleral depressed exam. And you know, there's great references to the Byers data, which Will is a huge fan of, dating to his days.
Love that guy.
Norm Byer. What do you always say? He had the most bang per publication.
Oh, yeah. Few publications, but high yield.
Every single one was meaningful. Yeah. And so what do you guys do? And I will start by prefacing that I scleral depress every PVD who comes in acutely. I do it on follow-up at least once or twice on follow-up. I do it more, quote-unquote, often if they have risk factors for tear and I don't have a tear, such as vitreous hemorrhage. But, again, there are patients I know that I did not get as good a depressed exam in as others. And there are patients that aren't as tolerant, and its question is, how much do you fight them to get that depressed exam in? And I kind of hope I strike a balance. So, Will, what do you do?
I do the same, but I don't... depress to see to the aura. I can usually see to the aura on most patients without depressing. I depress for the dynamic aspect of it. And so people always comment on, like, for instance, getting optos wide field imaging as a substitute for it. And maybe I'm just not as good at interpreting that as other people are, but I feel like I would miss tears on the optos wide field imaging alone. I just like the dynamic aspect of it. And for that, you don't usually really I find, don't need to depress very hard, just because you're basically just rolling it around and watching the retina and make sure nothing flips up. But I do.
And so you depress on 100%?
Of symptomatic PVDs.
Yeah, sure.
So I'm going to take the, I guess, probably the minority stance in this room and say that I actually don't depress.
And this matches data from surveys that have been done.
Yeah, and I think part of it is, it was actually the paper by Sinuhari Prasad in, I think was it Ophthalmology a few years back that actually kind of changed my mind on this. And he actually looked at, I think it was 100 eyes, 50 who were symptomatic, 50 who were not symptomatic. And then there was actually no significant difference in identifying pathology. And just by, you know, what we're doing is it's essentially a game of risk. And then there's a game of probability that's played in all acute PVDs. And so the probability is in acute PVD, you're going to have pathology at the posterior margin of the insertion of the vitreous base. You're not going to have pathology at the aura. And so we always talk about this sort of like concept of being able to see out to the aura, but we actually know that the pathology is never at the aura. It's actually posterior.
Never is a strong statement. So we have
in the setting of acute PVD.
But this is such an interesting thing, right? So there's multiple things. Is A, do you pick up additional tears with the exam? B, do the additional tears that you pick up matter, right? And then, you know, you referenced Hari Prasad's study. My big problem with that problem, it's a beautiful study they did. And they
it's also a very small number of individuals.
It's hard to get That's a very important concept. A small study for what we're talking about in terms of risk.
Yeah.
So my thing is, we have all had patients where we've gotten to the OR and we found a causative break, a tiny break that is at the aura. Usually it's at the vitreous base, but you will find breaks at the aura that are causative breaks for detachment. And I agree with Will. I'll be very honest. I think of myself as a human being, and I definitely go through these depressed exams. I'm like, you know, and every time I'm feeling like maybe I should stop, I've depressed a patient, and because of the dynamic, I find a flap that I wouldn't have seen otherwise.
And out of curiosity, so what's your strategy? Do you, in acute PVD, do you throw the headset on like first?
No.
Or do you look at them with a slit lamp and do a
I do a 360 sweep at the slit lamp with my, and I use a 90 diopter lens, and then I sit them back and I do depressed 360 because I actually think the 90 gets up pretty far.
Yes.
And it's great.
It does get up. I love it.
And then I use the indirect exam, not even to get up further, but again for the dynamic portion to see that things are moving. And some people are really good. I've heard people depressed at the slit lamp or super talented. There's things you can do. But my second point was, do the breaks matter? So I find those breaks and we treat them. I think they matter. We all think they matter. But the question is, if most people aren't depressing and they aren't finding those breaks, are all those breaks and cause detachments? And the Byers data says maybe not. So we obviously want to find all of them, but what's the number needed to treat to reach it? And obviously the risks of depression are not the same as risks of a treatment. But it's just an interesting
conversation. Well, they're also, I'm blanking on the name of it. I actually use it. Maybe it's the digital clear field.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm not a consultant for Voke, but I do love that lens. But it also allows you a wider field of view, even than the 90. And by the way, for all the residents who are listening and my fellows, you still have to learn how to do scleral depression because you otherwise are not going to be very effective at treating them. Because I do find scleral depression to be immensely, immensely valuable for the treatment of this, for laser resection. Retinopexy, and it can really turn a procedure into a 5-minute procedure once you're facile at scleral depression.
And the one note, I think, because we do have trainees listening, you need to get good at scleral depression.
Absolutely.
Right? So this is not what we're talking about. We're not saying you should not do scleral depression. You need to have the ability to do it because there are circumstances in the office when you need to treat a tear and you need to scleral depress them and do a good job. As Will Park told me when I was a first year, I remember I brought a patient to you multiple times in the same day and I kept being like, how does the laser look? And he kept looking and be like,
oh, I remember that. That was
and he kept looking and he was like, oh, it looks pretty good, but what about that anterior edge? And I'm like, and then I came back like, I think I got it. And he's like, you know, it looks about the same as last time you showed it to me.
Oh, that's a great day. I love that day.
I think you were at Dr. Albini's or Davis.
Patient fellows. And very, we thank you,
very
Will,
very
for that.
Very nice. But the point is you need to get good at it. Yeah. And unfortunately, I'm going to say, I think there are people, both in our field and other subspecialties, who aren't as comfortable with scleral depression because you never overcame that learning curve. So we are not talking about the ability to do it. We're talking about the necessity of doing it once you're good at it.
Yeah, and I will say this. When I say I don't scleral depress, I do a very thorough exam with the digital wide field lens. Again, I'm blanking on the name of this lens, but at the slit lamp. And if there are any areas that I find to be even remotely suspicious or areas where I didn't feel like I got an adequate exam, then I scleral depress in those areas. So I'm not doing a comprehensive 360-degree scleral depression, But inevitably, when I see a patient, there's going to be some areas where I'm not 100% certain, and those are the areas that I double check with.
Here's the thing. Some patients just can't, you can't get an exam sometimes. I mean, I'll be very honest. I feel like we're always supposed to be like, you got to get that exam. You got to see everything, whatever. There are some patients you just cannot, whether it's pseudophakia with a bad capsule or they're just not cooperative.
And and so do you torture them until you get the exam that makes you feel really happy? Or, you know, what's the happy medium in this situation?
Well, the other question is if you, I try to document if that's the case. So I try to document if a view is difficult or views. I don't know what that means. Like, I'll document that. I'll be like, poor cooperation or difficult exam. But like, the real question came down to the medical legal part of this. Well, none of us are lawyers, but like, you know, what Will and I are saying, we depressed, you're not. I think it's really hard though to assign, because you can say you're depressed and your exam could be inferior to someone who did not depress, right? Examination is so subjective.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point.
So how do you ever, that's why I think I agree with them in what they were saying, that you can't say that it's a required part, because you have no idea what anyone's seeing when they're looking.
Yeah.
So unless there's a documented photo, for example, from that day that shows a tear, and then it wasn't picked up on an exam, there's no way to even know if the tear was there. This is the hardest thing with retina. Your tear could have developed days later if the patient had a detachment.
Yeah, and along the lines of that, like you were saying, Yasha, sometimes if it's a really small pupil, it's just easier to use the slit lamp lens, the 90 lens at slit lamp.
You get a better exam.
So why waste your time mashing on their eye in that situation?
You know, I think ultimately it's the same sort of hand waving that occurs in surgery, right? And you do what's most comfortable to you to get the best possible exam. And then, you know, I know it sounds like we've talked about this sort of as this sort of cheesy sort of solution, but you do what you would do to your mother. And I think that's actually like a really, you know, have that level of certainty when that patient leaves the room that you actually have done well by that person. And this is, you know, we like to think of this as sort of a medical legal issue, but my sort of sense is that whether you depress them, you're going to have patients show up with detachments. If you don't depress them, you're going to have patients show up with detachments. That's a game of probability and being in the game long enough. And fortunately, that's a rare event, but it's an event that will happen independent of whether or not you're depressing them, in my hands. So therefore, my practice pattern was devised over the course of a few years based on what I think I'm pretty good at.
As long as you're reviewing, people review their results and they're happy with their results in terms of what, you know, the percentage of patients that fail, I think that's a reason.
Yeah. I think that's hard though, because the patient sometimes may not come back to you. They might show up to a different, you may never know.
Yeah.
You don't know what the ultimate numerator is going to be, right?
So yeah, it is true.
And the ultimate goal, though, if they do have a tear, right, is if you missed a tear, is to have it not become a Macoff detachment, right? So giving them symptoms is very, very important too. If you aren't sure, in situations where media is unclear things, I'll actually give them much more aggressive symptoms. I'll see them sooner, because the ultimate goal is if you do find an artery, you don't want it to be Macoff, because you want to induce personal damage.
I have a question. Have you guys ever seen a complication or a consequence, negative consequence of scleral depression?
I have. I'll let you go first.
I have not.
I have not either.
Yeah.
I had one, but they depressed pretty hard. It was a trainee, and they depressed so hard that when you looked in the back of the eye, you could see there was actually a big hemorrhage in the area.
Like a choroidal hemorrhage?
Yeah, choroidal hemorrhage. A localized choroidal from the depression.
I'm actually surprised it doesn't happen more often, to be honest. We have surgical wounds on some of these eyes and incisions, and we have eyes with scleral walls that are of differing thicknesses, and it's kind of interesting it doesn't happen that often.
The other thing that's scary, you know, sometimes in the OR, you ever been in a very myopic thin scleral case where you're depressed in the OR, you can see the metal of your depressor as you're depressing. Doesn't that scare you? Because in the office, when you do that, you oftentimes have a sense, because you're in the OR, you can see it's blue, whatever. In the office, you know, we don't really think about that. In theory, if it was thin enough, you could push hard enough that you could intrude. And there's been horror stories. I've never actually, I don't know if there's apocryphal, but there's been horror stories of that happening intraoperatively. I've never heard of that in the clinic.
So I did a surgery recently with a fellow, and it was a scleral buccal, and when we took down the conge in the supratemporal quadrant, the whole thing was blue in the supratemporal quadrant. And so we were working, we were doing our buccal, and the fellow was being very ginger with the scleral depressor for that. And then I said, you know, I said, didn't we depress this patient in clinic? They said, yeah. I said, well, you depressed them in clinic and they survived it okay. So, you know, if you feel like you need to depress them, just be a little careful. But I don't know. It's a resilient eye.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing I would, and there was no problems with that case.
No problems with that case.
Okay.
And we still did belt loops, FYI.
Dang.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right.
I do think
that's a man's
that
man.
Is,
man's
that is. Buckle. That's how you know he went to Bascom through and through.
Do you suture?
I do suture.
I sutured.
Yeah.
Voted. So before we go, this has been, we ran a little long, but that was a great conversation. I missed sub day. I was working. I couldn't go. I had stuff to do, and this couldn't happen this year. So what did I miss? What would you say if your listeners out there did not have a chance to go sub specialty day? Will, 5 minutes, take home points. Yash, can comment or add on top of it.
Every time I see a talk on vitrectomy for diabetic macular edema, I get a little bit seduced by it temporarily and wonder whether I should be doing more vitrectomies for diabetic macular edema. And Gorshaw gave a very nice talk on it on the first day of sub day, and it just kind of reviewing the literature and talking about, you know, if you're going to do a peeling ILM and how to figure out which patients to operate on. And I always go out of those things just thinking hard about it, and I have yet to really change my practice, but perhaps I should consider doing more early vitrectomies for diabetic macular edema.
I've done a couple. I've been underwhelmed with the results, but again, it's anecdotal. I like the idea. This is a whole different conversation, so I'll let you talk about subday first. And Dan Chow's talking about it. I like the idea of vitrectomy early for PDR.
Yeah.
For DME, I've not had great results, but maybe, you know, my end's not large enough. I'm not doing something right, but
I don't know.
Yasha?
Yeah, no, I mean, subday, awesome surgical videos. I always learn a ton from subday. It is the two best days in retina in any conference.
Really?
I do think so. You know, it's like
not
kind
to
of
be
a
critical. It's a great meeting, but I don't think that's
it's not a very good summary of everything that's happened over the course of the year.
If you have to go to one meeting the whole year, and if you're out in practice, I think it's the best one.
Yeah. And then also a special shout out to Steve Charles and Phil Rosenfeld, who, you know, very deservedly have won some incredible awards. It kind of goes to show you all the great things that have happened in retina, and both of those individuals deserve the accolades that were bestowed upon them.
Last thing, what did you guys think of phase 3 results presented, the Abicipar, Sequoia Cedar results 1 year, non-inferiority to ranibizumab, you know, but then they had this inflammation rate that was high. It was like 10 to 15%. It was extremely high. Obviously, we won't know anything until the full results come out, but this is phase 3. So we're getting close to prime time, right, for the DARPins. Thoughts, Yasha?
It's a good question. For the sake of full disclosure, I do consult for Allergan. But what I will
I do too,
say,
actually. I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
I'd also consult for Allergan.
I don't. Yeah. I'm clean.
So what I will say for that is that it really is there's gradations of inflammation, and the severity level has actually been demonstrated to be relatively. The range was pretty vast. And so the question is, how did those individuals fare in the clinical trial? How were they controlled? And what is our accepted tolerance in the setting of, how do they do overall, and what was the treatment required? That's ultimately going to determine whether or not this is a drug that that gets through the FDA.
Will Park, Yasha Modi, you guys are amazing. Thank you for doing this. I know you guys are tired. It's been a busy few days. Will's got like 15 ribbons on his badge right now. I'm looking at. I've got to go get my ribbons at some point instead of staying in my room doing podcasts.
Do I get a podcast ribbon?
Yeah, I want to get. Yep. We should get a podcast ribbon. Yep. That would be great. Guys, thank you so much. Have a wonderful rest of your academy.
Thanks, all right, Jay. Thank you.
So we thought we were done, but then we finished, and then we started thinking about one other thing about PVDs and tears. So, Yash, you wanted to talk a little about incomplete PVDs before we go, because we're totally nerding out right now.
Yeah, no, I think that's – but it's not nerding out. It's about, again, this,
it is nerding
this whole
out, but
conversation
it's still
is about risk reduction, right? And risk reduction is the name of the game in retinal tears. It's the name of the game in acute PVDs. And acute PVDs is – it's really important to think of this as a spectrum where we do have a clear Weiss ring, and then in the way that Bill Smitty has driven this into our heads is that if you do not see a Weiss ring, you do not have a PVD. And we oftentimes get confused with sort of vitreous condensations over the nerve. And so I do like to evaluate the highlight. I like to actually move the beam off center. And that's a big part of my evaluation at the slip beam, to really understand where the highlight is in relation to the retina. And if I can't tell, I always have a portable B scan in my room. And I do like to put the B scan on these individuals.
People don't have a portable B scan in every room, Yasha Modi.
Right.
Don't show off. That makes me jealous.
You know, what does a non-portable B scan look like? Just out of curiosity.
Oh, we have a big B scan,
okay.
And it,
I mean,
it has
like
to
that
stay
big
in
cart
my room.
That, like,
that's pretty
know.
Portable.
You have to unplug it and replug it. You're talking about like a laptop.
This is like
a
yeah, it's like
a little
laptop.
Units, the little
yeah,
unit.
The, yeah, the yeah, tiny yeah, little yeah, units yeah, yeah. that you can fit
you
on.
You guys
any
are too
table.
Fancy for me. I like the thing on the cart.
Yeah,
put
it's
your
a
drink
better quality.
It, you know.
I mean, I'm going to say one thing before Will goes. I think the other concept is even if you have a Weiss ring, that doesn't mean the hyaloid is lifted off the retina. Anywhere past
yeah.
the nerve, right? It could be down, and we've seen this surgically, it could be down outside the arcades, it could be down in the mid-periphery. And so I try to tell patients this is a dynamic process. Why do we do that exam? if they have no new symptoms, because the hyaluronate has continued to lift and lift and lift lift over time. And eventually, why do patients get tears 10 years later? Because the hyaluronate never completely releases from the vitreous base. So they can always get tears from the vitreous base, although the risk goes down and down and down over time. Right. It never goes to zero. So, Will, your turn.
Oh, man, I'm so excited. I've been looking up at you guys on your soapboxes all hour long. So I think I've talked about this once before. I can't remember, honestly, whether I've talked about this or not. I love and would encourage people to consider getting, when you do your, if you get OCTs on detachments preoperatively, to always scan through the nerve, because I think that that is extraordinarily useful determination of the extent of PVD. And
does it change your preoperative planning?
Absolutely.
What do you do differently?
Well, I'm a lot more inclined, if I don't see a complete PVD there, to in surgery look for it, make sure that if I'm concerned, you know, use dilute Kenalog or something if I'm concerned about it, or perhaps if it's a, you'd be more inclined to use a primary buckle versus
so you will change your vitrectomy plan maybe based on that.
So I know a lot more definitively what the PVD. I think the hyaluronate status is probably the determining criterion of what surgical procedure I choose at this point in time.
Shout out to Dr. Mark Spurn, who maybe people haven't heard. He's at Will's attending, and he was one of my attendings of fellowship. And one of the things he told me, I presented RD to him, the most important question, he said, there's one question I'm going to ask you. What is that? And I couldn't guess. And he said, the most important question asking you to call me about an RD is there a PVD or
that's
not?
That's right. That's absolutely
that
right.
Was the most important, because in his mind, the way he thinks is that tells you you're going leaning more buckle or you're going more vitrectomy. Now, you have people who do buckle vitrectomies, do things in between. But which way are you going with that, especially if a patient's kind of in between on the age spectrum?
But that is a hard question to answer. And the more myopic they become, that is an even more hard question in the setting of vitreous schisis. And so I do like the use of the B-scan. And I will say, in all vitrectomies, something that I've adopted is that I do go down to the optic nerve on every single case, and I do aspirate over the nerve, even in cases where I'm almost 100% sure there's a
lacerate. I don't even do that. I use dilute steroid every single RD.
Yes, I agree with that too.
And not everyone does that. There's cost reasons. Yeah. I'm obviously insulated because I'm in a hospital, university place practice. There's obviously reasons that that's easier for me to do than other people.
And Will, do you do that?
Not universally, but I do a lot.
He's a better surgeon than both of us put together.
That's totally true. Yeah. And by the way, he also taught us. So if we're not any good.
But there's not much. There's not much cost issue to it.
He didn't zap us.
Yeah. But I agree. I agree that with all that. Oh, and like for instance, a pseudophake with a, if the hyaluronate's partially attached, maybe I'll put a buckle on that eye.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Dominique will be disappointed in me, unfortunately, I think.
That's okay. He's disappointed in all of us. I think it's a level. Guys, thank you again. This is our second goodbye.
That was an encore.
Encore. We never had an encore before, but we're all here in person. So thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's RETINAPodcast.com. There are 138 episodes, including this one, and they can be found there sorted by category. You'll find our blog, Equal Rounded Reactive Lessons for Our Pupils. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. Like our Facebook page, you can find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at RetinaPodcast, and the contact us link on our website, or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Feedback is the lifeblood of what we do, so please give us feedback on things we can do better and things we're already doing well as episode ideas for the future. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Drs. Modi and Park for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benincasa, and Angela Chang for producing and publicizing this great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Dr. Jay Schrader, signing off.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.